Letters pop out from a white background, then turn red. Netflix.
A Netflix original documentary.
In 1964, got a job on a radio station. They needed somebody from midnight to, must have been 4 or 6 a.m. The station policy was you can only play the same top 10 songs over and over and over again. I was so bored that I announced on the air, if anybody's listening to this program and would like to engage in a little bit of a banter, just a little discussion, not much, just a 30 seconds, it would be great. I'll give you $25, first person to call us in. This is before talk radio, by the way. And nobody called in. I upped it to $50. Nobody called in. I got up to $100. Not a soul called in.
A young man with curly hair and a beard. An older man looks in a mirror.
And I had a feeling of what so many people have felt and continued to feel for years. Of desperately wanting to be heard. And nobody is listening.
The older man packs luggage and leaves his house. A crowd of protesters. A placard says, Lindsey Graham, no cap trade, no amnesty. People raise their arms and hold hands.
There's a huge amount of anger and frustration in the United States. It's been growing for years.
The speaker boards a plane.
People are worried about their jobs. They're worried about their wages. They feel like they don't have a voice in deciding anything that pertains to them, politically or economically. I pick this up everywhere I go.
Inspired by the book by Robert B. Reich.
Americans all over the country are asking, how can we make our voices heard?
He steps out on stage in front of a packed auditorium. The title appears, Saving Capitalism. Robert signs copies of his book in a store.
Well, thank you.
The view moves down a sunny highway towards an exit ramp for Newport KY. Some people stand to applaud Robert. He sits pensively in the back of a car.
The name of the book is Saving Capitalism. I've got two kind of reactions just to the title. Saving Capitalism, wait a minute, that implies that there's something wrong with capitalism.
A sign at the roadside announces Missouri. At an event, he signs a book for a young boy.
And there are others who say, why would you want to save capitalism?
He's fitted with an earpiece.
Robert Reich, professor of public policy at UC Berkeley and former Secretary of Labor under President Clinton.
You have captured this moment in American culture and American politics very well in this book. It's Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few.
We got about 20 seconds. Can you define...
No, we have a lot more time than that, Mike.
Can you define the aspirations of the middle class today as opposed to 30 years ago?
I think the aspiration of the middle class today is almost exactly what it was 30 years ago. That is, let's have a better life. If I'm working hard, I want my children to have a better life. Upward mobility is what people are expecting from the system, but they aren't getting it. Most Americans now have severe doubts about the system. They think the system's rigged.
The real issue is the system working for most people, or is it working for a very small group, becoming smaller and smaller at the top?
Robert Reich, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Former Labor Secretary under President Clinton, professor.
Robert walks out to a car.
These days, a lot of people certainly know the game is rigged. They hear that, they feel it, but they don't know exactly how it's rigged.
A cyclist pedals across a city intersection.
I wanted to go to where people didn't really know me, my books. I wanted to go to places where I could actually interact. I didn't expect to sell many books, but I did hope to learn something.
At Communities Creating Opportunity.
Hi, Ewa.
Welcome.
Nice to see you.
Great to finally meet you. Look who we found.
Good morning.
Reverend
Welcome
Jan
to
Rattles.
Kansas City.
Well, Reverend.
How are you?
Thank you. Hi, Claudia. You're chair of the board.
I am a part of this work because of my family and my community. My youngest son, Paul, married and has four little children, has worked all of his life. But unlike when I started to work as a young person, he seems to find jobs that don't have livable wage. They're not full-time jobs. He works 60 hours plus a week to take care of his wife and four kids and still struggles a lot, even to the point that he's had to move back in my house with his family of six at one point, because they continue to struggle. His wife has like $100,000 in debt in student loans. She has a master's degree. She has no job. It is not an uncommon story in our community.
Unfortunately, Claudia, I'm hearing it all the time. And it's a story that affects huge numbers of Americans.
A lot of these things that we're talking about, it, to me, is all a spinoff of an economy that has been immoral from its inception. It was not designed to include everyone in a fair way in the sense of access. How do you reform something that's immoral at its core?
There's nothing inherent in an economic system that makes it either immoral or moral, or good or bad. It depends on how it's organized. And if it's organized for people, then it can be a good and moral system.
Share prices scroll across the board. Electronics are assembled.
Our American economic system, capitalism, is a system based on private property and a free exchange of goods and services.
One of America's greatest strengths is our free market.
Let the free market system decide.
We all believe in the free markets. You know, that's what our capitalist system is about.
The law of supply and demand, operating unimpeded by government.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Robert addresses a full theater.
Few ideas have more profoundly poisoned the minds of so many as the notion of a free market existing somewhere in the universe into which the government intrudes.
Orbiting planets in a diagram of goods and services.
There's no such thing as a free market without government making the rules of the game.
The diagram is circled by a stream of paper.
What kind of rules? Rules governing property, monopoly, contracts, bankruptcy, and enforcement. Let's take property. Until the 1860s, human beings were lawful property in the United States. It took years of activism and a civil war, but Americans finally made slavery illegal. Or take bankruptcy. If you're big business, you can declare bankruptcy over and over again to protect your assets. But if you're a student, you can't reorganize your debt in bankruptcy. Or if you're a homeowner who's underwater because the entire market has collapsed, you can't use bankruptcy. It's illegal. These rules don't come from nature. They reflect the interests of those with the most power, which means they change over time.
A man in a high tower with piles of money. 1992. Bill Clinton addresses a crowd.
In the name of all those who do the work, pay the taxes, raise the kids, and play by the rules. In the name of the hardworking Americans who make up our forgotten middle class, I proudly accept your nomination for President of the United States.
Just about 50 years ago, I met Bill Clinton. I had already met Hillary Rodham. She was an undergraduate at Wellesley. I had been president of my class at Dartmouth. We were both involved in student government. So I knew her, and I knew Bill, and even the first day of Yale Law School, I was sitting there in the cafeteria talking to Bill Clinton, and Hillary came up and she said, "Bob, how are you?" And I said, "Great, Hillary, I want to introduce to you my friend from Oxford." We were just at Oxford together, Bill Clinton. And she said, "Hi, Bill." And he said, "Hi, Hillary."
A photo of young Bill and Hillary.
And then 25 years ago, Bill Clinton called me. He wanted me to be his Secretary of Labor. And I was excited because maybe we could actually make some real progress.
You have this pent-up demand in the country for something that is very, very different, that has a different vision. We wanted to create the possibilities for people who were not really yet participating in the economy, because it was building the future of the country. It was building the capacity of the country to not only grow, but to bring everybody along in that growth.
Bill Clinton is handed a saxophone and plays with a band.
We were young. You know, we were the new generation. We were the boomers. I was going to go down and try to help him figure out what to do about the economy.
In focus this evening, the shrinkage in America's middle class. Even though the economy is now growing, many of the jobs it is creating pay poverty wages.
President Clinton has been promising wages would rise. But at the Labor Department, Secretary Robert Reich sees the number of working poor growing.
More and more of the nation's income and wealth were going to the top. People in the middle class was under greater and greater stress. The poor were not doing well at all. I thought we could actually reverse that direction. I spent a lot of time all over America. And what I got back from people was a lot of the skepticism and cynicism and the beginnings of the anger that has really emerged full force in 2016. It was just beginning then.
A sign by a country road says Missouri Rural Crisis Center.
The pleasure to introduce Secretary Reich to the Show Me State and to Mid-Missouri. Thank you for being here today.
As Tim said, this started out as a book tour. You know, and I've done a lot of books, and I've written a lot of books, and I've tried to help people understand what's really going on. I don't want to just go out to bookstores. I really want to talk to people about their lives. Yes, that's true.
Name's Darvin Bentledge, and I'm a farmer. And there's other names they use for me, but I just mainly go by farmer and cattleman.
Darvin drives in his truck.
Family farm has been around for 80 years. You're kind of raised into it. You know, I jumped on the first tractor when I was 10 years old. I could barely reach the pedals. It's a lot of hard work, but our margin of profits are way down, you know. Farm income this year has been predicted to drop 50%. Well, excuse me, nothing I buy has dropped 50%. I don't think anything in the grocery stores dropped 50%. The sun would kind of like to come back on the farm.
There's nothing that I would want more than to sell my home and move down here. And
the fiscal part of it's pretty rough.
What kind of profit margins are you pulling in a year?
Well, the profit margins, you know, varies. You gotta, but the total deal, you know, I make around the year before was like $320,000.
You spent
$300,000.
So, in my mind, your profit margin would have been $20,000, correct?
Yeah.
There is a vicious cycle that has set in. The American economy today is almost twice as large as it was in 1980, but the median wage has gone nowhere. In fact, if anything, most Americans' wages adjusted for inflation have declined. So where did all the money go? It went upward.
Robert speaks on stage. A graph shows corporate profit as a percentage of GDP.
In 2014, corporate profits before taxes reached their highest share of the total economy in at least 85 years. Meanwhile, the percentage of the economy going to people's wages has dropped dramatically.
A graphic shows a householder, goods and services, a businessman.
Hidden inside the rules of the market, money flows upward out of the pockets of average Americans and into the profits of major industries, executives, and shareholders. The vicious cycle is that as income and wealth go to the top, so does political power.
And here's where it gets interesting, because as political power goes to the top has more and more ability to influence the rules of the game.
A title, 1967. An aerial view of Washington, D.C. in the White House.
I began my political education when I went to Washington in 1967 as an intern for Robert F. Kennedy. Being in Washington was thrilling. People in the bottom 20% were getting ahead. In 1964, when our large and growing middle class was the envy of the world, roughly 77% of Americans said they trusted government to do the right thing. That's compared to 20% today. And Washington itself was kind of seedy in those days. There wasn't much money flowing into Washington. The business community was just beginning to come to Washington and set up shop. It was just starting.
A view of a large stone building.
In the late 1970s, I got a job as director of policy planning for the Federal Trade Commission. While I was there, we came out with a proposed rule that would ban advertising directed at children with regard to unhealthy, sugary products.
The Federal Trade Commission votes today on recommendations by its staff that would put tight new restrictions on television commercials that are aimed at children.
Advertisers are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars fighting the consumer groups and the FTC staff proposals. The makers of sugared cereals, candy, and toys are fighting back.
You would have thought we had declared World War III because the business community was so upset. I began to see businesses and business associations begin to get more and more power in Washington, more and more power over the legislative process. They closed down the Federal Trade Commission because of that rule.
A sign says closed due to lack of funding.
At the Consumer Complaints Office, yesterday's mail was unopened. Hearings with food companies were suspended. A laboratory machine that smokes 500 cigarettes a day to monitor tar and nicotine content of the different brands got a break. It didn't have to smoke.
What I discovered is that big corporations, Wall Street, very, very wealthy individuals, they could actually change laws and regulations to favor them and to hurt others. That process was almost invisible. It happened inside administrative agencies, inside legislatures, but the net effect of all of it was to very subtly change the rules of the game.
The Chamber of Commerce, United States of America.
What I witnessed had been quietly launched in 1971. The Chamber of Commerce, a powerful business lobbying group, asked a corporate lawyer named Lewis Powell to write a position paper. Known as the Powell Memo, his paper rapidly circulated among national business leaders. The American economic system, he said, is under broad attack. Business must learn the lesson that political power is necessary, that such power must be assiduously cultivated, and that when necessary, it must be used aggressively and with determination, without embarrassment, and without reluctance. His memo turned into a manifesto for new business-oriented think tanks, lobbying groups, trade associations, and professional organizations committed to shaping the government to better meet their needs. The vicious cycle was in full swing.
A graphic of hands shaking in front of the domed Capitol building. Banknotes slip out of a sleeve. Robert rides in the back of a car. A dinner meeting at a long table for the Association of Business Leaders.
First of all, let me ask a question. How do you like to be called? How should we call you?
Your Excellency.
I was going to say, Bob.
No, call me Bob. Can we go around the table and maybe
introduce themselves?
Yeah, everybody introduce themselves.
My name's Woody Kozad. I used to be a lawyer. Now I'm a lobbyist. And as one of my fellow right-wing friend says of me, I'm like a doctor who specializes in the diseases of the very rich. And so I try to represent people who can pay my bills. So I'm one of those evil guys manipulating the rules and changing the
market. Now, what do you, don't be defensive. You were.
I'm not defensive. I'm very proud of myself.
You were doing a job, and a job has to be done.
And I'm Crosby Kemper, the director of the Kansas City Public Library. And I was a Republican candidate for the state legislature in 1980, and I referred to myself then as I refer to myself now as a libertarian.
I have been a very moderate Republican and actually have helped a few Democrats. So I was happy that Crosby invited me. Thank you.
Well, you know what I would like to do, if you don't mind?
Please.
I would like to put party labels aside and not talk Democrats and Republicans, right, just for a little while. Because I really want to talk about how you view politics, the economy, your values.
You know, you want to dismiss the argument about government versus the market. I'm just talking about government. And people who operate that government will do so in their own self-interest. And that's what the Constitution was designed to limit. And so the government should be limited.
I was a regulator. I was at the Federal Trade Commission. We would come up with simple rules. And then the lobbyists would attack.
Right.
And they would say, you have got to give this little, make this exception, and this exception, and this exception. And then Congress would start calling, and they'd say, you know, our constituents, our business constituents want this exception. It's not either market or government. It is power that is misused.
Right. And let's talk about power. Let's talk about my two clients who started a company 20 years ago and are now billionaires. They employ 9,000 people. They pay hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes. They pay high wages. It's a high-tech company, value-added, generous benefits, and yet they're held up to scorn and hatred and ridicule and contempt because when they've added to income inequality, added to the concentration of wealth, added to disparity. Why are they the scapegoat? They're enacting the American dream. One of them is an immigrant.
Let's agree that there should not be any scapegoats and there's nobody evil here. Let's also agree that there's a problem.
I mean, I actually really like you. And I didn't expect to. But you vilified everything I've worked for all my life. I've had 4 very successful small businesses. I grew up poor in Springfield, Missouri. Student loans, worked my ass off, employed, I probably created 200 jobs. Okay, it's not a lot. I'm not the Koch brothers, but I worked my ass off. But you made me feel badly about what I've done for America.
A golf cart drives out of a garage. Annie Presley, entrepreneur.
My theory is work, take care of yourself, accept responsibility for yourself, regardless of what life throws at you.
Annie tees up a golf ball in sunshine.
Yes, we've made it. There's no question that we've made it.
Annie meets friends in a restaurant.
My husband and I pinch each other every day that we get to live in this lovely community. We're able to put his kids through college. But I think the opportunity for employment has become very complicated. Today, it's hard for people to really make ends meet.
Annie gets into a BMW convertible.
I don't feel like being 20 today is going to be as easy as it was when I was 20. It's just a different time. It's a very, very different time.
A check cashing store advertises payroll advance, a McDonald's.
I've been working at McDonald's for 4 years. I work at the drive-thru window. I get paid $12.55 per hour. I make about $1,200 a month. $900 goes straight to rent. And I have to pay for gas. And then my phone bill, I end up with nothing. We barely, barely make it.
Estamos vivendo. Gracias.
those big corporations can pay us more. They have the money. Me, as a cashier at my job, I know how much money goes in there, okay? And that it's only in few hours. They're open 24/7. I sometimes have to go to the payday loan and get a loan on my paycheck in order to make it on time and don't get any late fees and try to make ends meet.
Her name is Guadalupe.
Nobody should be working full-time and not making it. Nobody in our society, the richest country, the richest nation in the history of the world, should feel as frightened and anxious and as insecure as so many people do today.
Robert looks concerned. A man stands at the counter of his store. A guy closes the tailgate of a delivery truck. A sign for Brocco's Old Barn, hay, grain, and feed. A star and stripes flaps in the breeze outside a body shop. Elevators move up and down the side of a construction site.
The reality is that our system can reflect our values. Capitalism is what we make of it. Either the rules are going to expand opportunity and widen the circle of prosperity, or they're going to narrow opportunity.
Robert frowns as his car passes through a neighborhood of small houses.
The Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich. The Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin. And the President of the United States.
In 1995, on the White House lawn.
I don't know whether Bill Clinton organized his economic team so that people like me would have a good chance to make our case, but we'd lose a lot of the fights. What I do know is that it was a tough slog. To make economic policy, I was fighting very hard for maintaining the original goals of that campaign. We wanted to do away with some of the tax subsidies the federal government was giving corporations that left average people picking up the tab. Mm. The president had pledged to end the tax break for CEO pay.
The average CEO at a major American corporation, according to a recent Senate hearing, is paid about 100 times as much as the average worker. And our government today rewards that excess with a tax break for executive pay, no matter how high it is. That's wrong. If companies want to overpay their executives and underinvest in their future, that's their business. But they shouldn't get any special treatment from Uncle Sam.
A photo of President Clinton in the Oval Office.
There were voices, particularly in the Treasury, who wanted a very different rule. Bob Rubin had been the CEO of a big Wall Street bank and then became the Secretary of the Treasury. He viewed the economy and he viewed America through the eyes of Wall Street. And I remember the meeting, Rubin. He said, well, why don't we make it that you can't deduct CEO pay in excess of $1 million unless it's related to corporate performance. I said, wait a minute. This has nothing to do with corporate performance. It has to do with excessive CEO pay relative to the pay of average people. We're not talking about corporate performance. We're talking about widening inequality.
A graph shows CEO to worker compensation ratio.
Well, I lost that one. And because of this tax loophole, CEO pay skyrocketed in the form of stock bonuses. And this subsidy for executive pay was just one example of thousands of subsidies and tax breaks that go to corporations. The top five oil companies receive a combined $4 billion in tax breaks each year.
A graphic shows tax subsidies to corporations for big oil.
Google received $632 million in government subsidies to build data centers. And the United States Department of Agriculture spends $20 billion every year on subsidies that go mostly to the largest producers. These subsidies are costing taxpayers tens of billions of dollars every year. Some estimates put it at over $100 billion. That's more than the cost to fund the entire Department of Education.
$78.2 billion.
We have a huge system now of corporate welfare, aid for dependent corporations, subsidies and tax breaks that have no economic justification at all, that are there because individual corporations or specific industries have lobbied to get them. It's in the tax code. It's in appropriation bills. It's in our trade laws. Wherever you look, you find corporate welfare.
Robert speaking in 1995.
I began to feel in myself some anger toward people I knew in the administration with a lot of power. Not anger at them personally, because they were nice people. I enjoyed them. But anger at not only what they represented, but the narrowness of their view. It was as if Washington was an island that was separate from the rest of the country. The voices of average citizens had disappeared, all but disappeared.
An announcement from 1997.
Another member of the Clinton administration announced today that he's dropping out of the game entirely. Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who's been a central player on the president's domestic policy team, is returning to Massachusetts to spend more time with his family.
Robert climbs steps to a podium to address the press.
My friends, we are on the way to becoming a two-tiered society, composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind, whose anger and whose disillusionment is easily manipulated. Once unbottled, mass resentment can poison the very fabric of society, the moral integrity of a society, replacing ambition with envy, replacing tolerance with hate. Today, the targets of that rage, are immigrants and welfare mothers and government officials and gays and an ill-defined counterculture. But as the middle class continues to erode, who will be the targets tomorrow?
Crowds of people walk along a city street in slow motion. They walk off an escalator. An Asian flower seller peers around buckets of blooms.
You can see the cumulative effect of all of this over time. Wealth creating political power, creating changes in the rules that enhance wealth. It's not sustainable. It's getting worse and worse and worse.
2008, signs say foreclosure, bank owned and under contract.
Big trouble for millions of American homeowners as foreclosures across the country are up a staggering 87%.
The number of Americans either behind on their mortgage payments or in foreclosure rose to record levels in the third quarter.
Those mortgages made to borrowers with poor credit histories are called subprime loans. And the explosive growth in this kind of lending in the past few years is now having a devastating impact.
We are briefly interrupting regular programming with the latest on a wild day today on Wall Street in which the stock market officially crashed.
Now, three of the top five Wall Street institutions are gone, leaving many to wonder whether Americans can trust the system to keep their money safe.
So what happened in the 2000s? Well, Wall Street went amok. I mean, completely crazy. They're gambling with people's deposits. They're gambling with the entire economy. These are not aberrations. This is not an accident.
A graph of financial system rules.
Since the Reagan administration, there's been a systematic changing of the rules of our financial system. Always billed as deregulation that would get government out of our free market.
Government, with its high taxes, excessive spending, and overregulation, had thrown a wrench in the works of our free markets.
President Reagan speaking in the mid-80s.
Then in 1998,
Wall Street devised new complex financial instruments to maximize their profits, known as derivatives. Despite warnings, these went unregulated.
What are you trying to protect?
We're trying to protect the money of the American public, which is at risk in these markets.
Regulator Brooksley Bourne.
And then, in 1999, Clinton did away with the Glass-Steagall Act.
We are here today to repeal Glass-Steagall because we have learned that government is not the answer. We have learned that freedom and competition are the answers.
Republican Senator Phil Gramm, Texas.
The Glass-Steagall Act was a 1930s law designed to protect people's savings from being used by Wall Street speculators. But now, with no laws in place to keep risky investment banks from merging with commercial banks or control derivatives, we ushered in two big-to-fail megabanks that led to the stock market crash. You know, there's this fiction that somehow you have regulation or deregulation. You don't have regulation or deregulation. The question is what kind of regulation you have. You allowed commercial and investment banks to get together, and then what happened? You have a new kind of regulation. It's called bailouts.
Good evening, and even congratulations. You are now the proud owner of a massive insurance company. American taxpayers woke up this morning to learn their money makes up most of a bailout package the Federal Reserve slammed together to save a huge insurance conglomerate called AIG.
The rescue of Bear Stearns, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and AIG puts an extra $314 billion of taxpayer money at risk.
Here at home, the administration and Congress are hammering out the details for what would be the largest financial bailout in U.S. history.
This is a big package because it was a big problem.
President George W. Bush and the White House.
We're not getting rid of government. Remember, that's the point. Government is still going to be involved. The question is, how is government going to be involved? Is government going to be involved in terms of keeping banks relatively small and tame? Or is government going to be involved in dealing with the consequences from homeowners and everybody else, sweeping up the mess? In other words, it's not government versus no government. It's what are the government rules going to be?
A graphic shows spirals of paper around business, the homeowner, products, and services. A woman with a shaven head is Victoria Zorka, student and restaurant host.
I received my diagnosis in January of this year. After receiving an infection abroad, I came home and was treated for that. And while in the hospital, they discovered that I had cancer.
She has a drawer full of different medications.
I have a couple of different medications for nausea. There's two specific ones that I take on days 2 and 3 after chemo. I get a steroid when I'm in the hospital to get me through the treatment, an antibiotic, and another that helps me sleep because I get kind of a weird vertigo during a certain point of my treatment cycle. Even in the insurance provider that I have, I was informed that they no longer cover chemo drugs fully. And so we were told by a medical social worker that we could potentially receive a bill for thousands of dollars.
She studies statements of treatment costs.
With the 4 drugs that I take for chemotherapy, the total comes out to about $3,000 a month per treatment. But for me, that's about 3 months of income just for one round of treatment. What is the alternative to receiving your chemotherapy drugs? There isn't one. So whatever the cost is, you have to pay it.
Victoria nods and looks tense.
You and I and everybody else in this country pays more for pharmaceuticals than any citizens of any advanced nation. Why is it that we pay so much? That it has to do with the way in which pharmaceutical companies have got laws and rules that protect them. And that gives them huge market power, and that also gives them huge political power. And that political power is being exercised in all kinds of ways to tilt the market in their
direction.
The Capitol building on a sunny day.
In June of 2003, the Medicare Modernization Act came up for vote in the House.
This will be a 15-minute vote.
It was a bill that was ostensibly intended to help seniors pay for prescription drugs. But it would also bar the government from interfering with negotiations between manufacturers and pharmacies and prescription drug plan sponsors. In other words, it would prevent the government, with its huge purchasing power, from negotiating cheaper prices for drugs. So as new drugs hit the market, patients would have no choice but to pay the costs set by the drug companies. The bill was over 1,000 pages, and it was rushed to a vote in the House at 3 a.m. the next morning.
We had leaders going around and gathering around individuals, trying to twist their arms to get them to change their votes. I think a lot of the shenanigans that were going on that night, they didn't want on national television in prime time.
On this vote, the yeas are 220, the nays are 215. The conference report is agreed to. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
This is a piece of legislation that's hailed as a move toward a free market. But it's actually a government regulation that benefits only a few at the top.
The headquarters of drug company Pfizer and an aerial view of skyscrapers.
Similar manipulations to the rules of our economy are happening across our major industries. Americans pay more for internet service than the citizens of any other industrialized nation and have some of the slowest speeds. Because cable companies have enough political power to stifle competition. We're paying more for airline tickets because airlines have merged into just four major carriers that barely have to compete with each other. We pay more for health insurance as health insurers consolidate. So in every way, you see, they're using their political power, and that means you and I and every other American are paying more. How do these industries manage to get rules that benefit them? It's no mystery. Campaign contributions buy access to government officials.
A stream of money flowing into a politician.
Well-funded public relations firms, think tanks, and research institutes produce reports to promote those views and sometimes even draft the laws they want passed. Platoons of lawyers argue on their behalf in courts and regulatory proceedings in Washington. And finally, there's the revolving door. In the 1970s, about 3% of outgoing members of Congress became lobbyists. In recent years, 42% of retiring representatives and half of all retiring senators have turned to lobbying. Lobbying has been going on since America's founding. What has changed is the magnitude of corporate lobbying versus any other interests. It's gone from a cottage industry to an influence industrial complex. Today, corporate interests spend $34 for every $1 spent by unions and all public interest groups combined. In 2016, they spent a total of $3.15 billion on lobbying. That's the equivalent of $5.9 million per member of Congress.
A view across agricultural land.
I'm kind of independent. At times, I see both parties doing some stuff that I don't think is what they were elected to do. They don't care about what the promises they made to the people. They care about the promises they made to their backers that give them the money. And most of us out here, I don't contribute much to political deals, you know, because I'll vote for you. And if I vote for you, that's all I should have to do. I don't have to buy your loyalty to me. Their money is their voice. Why, excuse me, where did I miss that? money is used to purchase something, not as a voice. You know, so what are they purchasing? They're purchasing the influence of politicians.
Darvin climbs into his truck and drives down a track.
Do you feel that you are truly represented in Washington? Do you feel that this country is headed in the right direction? No one does. That's why I'm running for Congress. My name is Dave Pratt, and I'm a lifelong Republican and conservative. And I'm ready to take economics and ethics to Washington.
Congressman.
Hey, Bob.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time, seriously. I know you're in the middle of a campaign, and this is an imposition.
No, it's not. Pleasure to meet you.
But it's a great to meet you, too. I have a lot to talk to you about.
Great.
The Conservative Review has given you an award for being one of the two most conservative Republicans out of 247 Republicans in Congress.
Yeah.
You use the term crony capitalism.
Yeah.
What did you mean by crony capitalism?
The big folks get together, no matter what industry, protect their turf at the expense of the small guy. The government's job is to make sure that doesn't happen. Instead, the government's job has turned into they make that happen. I mean, I'm not against business, right? But I am against this crony business that takes advantage of the taxpayer. I do think it's coming. People, the intuition right now is clear. Something's wrong all over the country, right, left, everybody. Something's way off.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, that's
but what we're beginning to see is that it's actually anti-establishment versus establishment.
Yeah.
It's people who don't want the big money and the crony capitalism versus the crony capitalists.
Yeah.
You know, Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, there's going to be disagreement on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But if you could come together on these fundamentals.
It's fine with me. You're at a deeper level, right? You've been teaching economics and all that for 30 years. I used to use your book.
You used to use my book?
I used to use it.
Can
Work
we just make, can you?
And
can
I
we,
have a book out, too. While
can we get that again?
Mine.
Robert signs a book.
Congressman, what do you think of the title?
Yeah, I know. It surprised me a little bit coming for you, but in a pleasant way. I think you and I are united on we can do this in the right way, ethics and capitalism together, and we'll save the country.
Congressman, thank you.
Thank you very much.
A graph line weaves down between symbols representing goods and services.
Everything fundamentally comes down to American democracy. Is it working for most people? Or is it working for a very small number?
Hands shake in front of the Capitol. Banknotes slip out of a sleeve.
Researchers at Princeton and Northwestern University wanted to find out how much political power ordinary citizens have. They examined a 20-year period from 1982 to 2002. They first discovered that if large corporations and wealthy individuals, regardless of political party, want a law passed, there's nearly a 60% chance it will be passed. And if they don't want a certain law, it doesn't pass. Then they looked at everyday voters. Issues that almost no one supports have a 30% chance of becoming law. Issues that almost everyone supports also have a 30% chance of becoming law. They concluded in their own words, the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact upon public policy.
The statement is written out on paper on a clipboard. Preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero impact upon public policy. Robert walks through the sunny park opposite the White House.
I'm always struck by how close you can come if you're just an average American to the White House. But your voice can't really reach the decision makers in the White House.
Jacket slung over his shoulder, Robert approaches the White House security gate. A view looks down the reflecting pool towards the tall obelisk of the Washington Monument.
Over the last 50 years, Washington has become an emerald city. Its capital, money. Money that is there for only one purpose, and that is to influence outcomes.
A title, 2010,
on the colonnaded portico of the Supreme Court of the United States. The Citizens United decision. Senator John McCain, Republican, Arizona, approaches microphones to make an announcement.
It's apparent to me that there are certain judges who are alleging that somehow corporations have the same rights as citizens. I don't accept that premise.
The U.S. Supreme Court today overturned laws on the books for nearly a century and ruled that corporations can spend freely now on political campaigns.
What's the point in individual people trying to influence politics with their donations if Exxon or some other company can quite literally match and therefore cancel out the combined donations of every single individual donor in the nation?
Well, the cacophony now of special interests with megaphones larger than you've ever seen in your life will drown out the voice of the people.
The bottom line is this. The Supreme Court has just predetermined the winners of next November's elections. It won't be Republicans, it won't be Democrats, it'll be corporate America.
A definition: dark money, noun. Political campaign contributions made without disclosing donors' identities. A graph shows total dark money spending before and after Citizens United decision. It's much greater after. 2011, and a demonstration on the streets of New York.
There was a giant show of support for the Occupy Wall Street movement Wednesday. Approximately 10,000 people marched through Lower Manhattan.
The truth is that many of the reasons they're hitting the streets are similar to the reasons the Tea Partiers began their protests. Crony capitalists, bailouts to big business.
Washington should listen to their message because it is similar to the Tea Party's message. That is, crony capitalism needs to stop.
A split screen shows the Tea Party on one side and Occupy Wall Street on the other.
They're spending our children's money, our grandchildren's money, and they're going to just continue to push this country into debt, and they're going to destroy the economy of America.
This country is upside down, and it's not working for 99% of our society anymore. The 1% keep getting richer, and everyone else is getting poorer and poorer.
It seems to me that the blame has to be placed on the shoulders of both parties, and it's time we send a clear message to them. You either stop railroading our people in our country, or we're going to throw all you bums out.
The title announces 2016.
It is 9 p.m. on the East Coast, and the moment of truth has arrived. Welcome to the first debate night of the 2016 presidential campaign, live from Quicken Loans Arena.
Mr. Trump,
you've also donated to several Democratic candidates. You explained away those donations, saying you did that to get business-related favors. And you said recently, quote, when you give, they do whatever the hell you want them to do.
You better believe it.
So what specifically did they do?
I will tell you that our system is broken. I give to many people. Before 2 months ago, I was a businessman. I give to everybody. When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them, 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. They are there for me.
So what?
And that's a broken system.
I have never heard a candidate, never, who has received huge amounts of money from oil, from coal, from Wall Street, from the military-industrial complex. Not one candidate. These campaign contributions will not influence me. I'm going to be independent. Well, why do they make millions of dollars of campaign contributions? They expect to get something. Everybody knows that.
You've received millions of dollars in contributions and speaking fees from Wall Street companies. How do you convince voters that you're going to level the playing field when you're indebted to some of its biggest players?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that they know that I will. You've got two billionaire hedge fund managers.
The Bentledge Family Farm.
They want to hear about your thoughts on Donald.
Oh, yeah.
Trump.
Brutally honest?
Go for it, yeah.
I think he's a great businessman.
Oh.
I think what the country needs is a businessman standpoint.
Yeah. Do you know he's against the union?
A lot of people. Yeah, I do. Okay. I do. A lot of people don't like to hear it, but I think that's what this country needs, is a businessman, not a politician. I'm totally thinking that we're being led too much by politics. politics
yes.
instead of running this country like a business.
But Donald Trump just, it's a joke. It makes it into a joke. We're agree a joke with that,
but
countries.
He addresses a lot of the issues
the
that are on.
Anger or issues.
It's anger. It's anger. He's using the people's anger over the way government is operated.
And why do you think he's getting the reaction that he's getting? It's because he's saying stuff that people are thinking.
People, yes.
He's getting the reaction of the people.
He's trading on the frustration.
Exactly. And that's why I like Bernie and I like Trump. I mean, I'm torn. Bernie is a smart, intelligent man.
Yes. Bernie is my man.
So it's not Republican and Democrat.
Oh, no.
Well, it's both of them.
No, it's both of them.
So
if it was up to me, I would say, hey, let's get a fresh stack of people that we can put in office because I don't like any of them now.
Re-elect nobody.
Huh?
Right, re-elect nobody.
Yeah, there you go.
Let's elect Willie Nelson.
The Farmhouse at Dusk.
Populism is a reaction against those in power, in favor of the broad public. But populism, let me hasten to say, has two very different faces. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. But to be more general about it, when people are angry and frustrated and afraid and they feel economically insecure, they tend to either move toward authoritarian populism, which is, you know, give me the strong man who's just going to fix everything on behalf of the people, but is anti-democratic and often uses scapegoating as a way to generate greater and greater support. Or, alternatively, populism can take the form of reform. That is, we're going to rebuild the system. We're going to create a very, very different system that is much more reflective of the people's needs. So populism is not necessarily good. It depends on what form it takes.
Photos of people debating. Placards say disagree and healthcare is right. There are faces of despair. A placard says, "Dear elected representatives, first, do no harm."
Faith in our major institutions have plummeted over the last 30 years. And this is dangerous because if people don't trust that our society is working for most people, then they are very vulnerable.
Donald Trump addresses a rally. A title announces January 2017. President Trump is sworn in on the steps of the Capitol.
We are at a critical turning point in this country. And we're either going to go toward authoritarian populism over the long term, or we're going to go in the direction of democratic, fundamental democratic change. A democracy is a very fragile thing.
Robert goes into a bookstore.
The other day, I was going through the airport. Somebody came up to me, complete strangers, and she said to me, "So what are we going to do?" I said, "I don't know." And then other people at other airports and other places, they come up and they say, "Can you believe it?" The way we get our economy back really is about the way we get our democracy back. And that is getting together and creating institutions that countervail the power of the biggest corporations and the biggest banks and the wealthiest people. Citizenship is more than just voting and jury duty and paying taxes. Citizenship really is participating and engaging and making a ruckus when a ruckus is necessary. It's all of our responsibilities to make sure for ourselves, but also for our children and for our grandchildren, that we make this thing work. Thank you. Thank you for coming tonight. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I stay positive, first because I know American history. I know that every time capitalism gets off the rails, our instinct in this country is to put it back on the rails.
Old black and white photos of men in top hats and women in plumed hats. A working man with a dirty face and hand sits at a small table.
We are seeing the same kind of concentrated income and wealth, the same kind of political corruption. We saw the same thing in the 1880s, 1890s. And the rules added to the wealth, and you saw a similar kind of vicious cycle to the vicious cycle we have now. People became so angry, and that anger was channeled in a positive direction. People organized themselves and changed the organization of the political economic system.
A banner, Get Out the Vote, CIO Political Action Committee.
The first major antitrust legislation was passed, which broke up huge monopolies. And then President Teddy Roosevelt signed a law that prohibited corporate donations to political campaigns. We don't succumb as other countries have, to fascism or communism. We are much more pragmatic than that. And I think we'll do it again.
A homeless man sits on a crate on a street. Another lies on a sidewalk as men in suits walk by. Aerial view of an extensive and luxurious country club. Children cluster around a small kitchen to eat. Sleep rough on benches. A man in a tie and suspenders gets out of a luxury car. A woman in furs passes a homeless man. A woman jogs by a man wrapped in blankets. A title, The University of California, Berkeley. People walk under umbrellas in the rain. A Mini pulls into a parking garage. Robert approaches the porch of a house.
I'm also optimistic because I teach. I surround myself every day with young people, and I see in young people today a huge yearning, a huge dedication to making the system work.
Robert follows students into a lecture theater. The attendees settle in the packed auditorium.
It's a time of great, great opportunity and great, great danger. Some of you, and I don't know who it is, and I don't know how many of you, will be part of the solution. Some of you will be leaders.
A session for graduate students in public policy.
This is the most extraordinary historic period I've lived through, and I'm old enough to have lived through a number. This summer marks the 50th year for me that I've been involved in and out of government, and so it's a little bit humbling to think that it's been 50 years and we're in deeper shit than we were then. If you've got young people who don't have the experience of a system that is actually working, then where do they get their idealism from?
He nods thoughtfully.
Where is the next generation going to draw its strength from?
I wouldn't say that American history has had a golden age and we've passed it, but I do think that at least there was a sense that we were better together. There's a sense of shared identity. And I don't think that exists much anymore.
Certainly there's moments of, like, despair and hopelessness and, like, this sense that, like, all of this is for nothing. So, like, that is, that comes too. Like, you have to believe things will get better or you'll just always be living in the hopelessness.
But I guess it's also an opportunity because people are also getting more aware and more understanding of the challenges, and that's mobilizing people also into making people act and reflect on and participating in politics. So it's hope.
You know, I wish with hindsight that when I had had the opportunity in government, I wish I had pushed harder.
Robert nods reflectively.
But at the time, I thought I was pushing as hard as I could, as hard as I dared. It's now up to the next generation.
He nods, his expression solemn. A vast rally marches towards the Capitol. Some protesters carry placards. Others sit in front of the police.
All social change occurs when people become aware of a tension between the ideal they carry around in their heads about how the system really ought to work and the reality they see around them. And when that tension becomes too great, that dissonance becomes too intense, they are willing to take action.
A placard says, "Text enough already." Marchers carry a banner that says, "Huelga."
It's getting a little bit better because we are doing something to make a change. I've been fighting for $15 in the union for about 3.5 years.
Guadalupe.
What do we want? $15 in the union? What do we want it?
My friends, this is about power. It's about reclaiming our democracy and reclaiming our economy.
A title, Californian Minimum Wage Victory.
This is a huge victory. I feel very proud. Because now the rest of the nation is looking on us. And they're seeing that 15 per hour, it's achievable. We can do it.
A photo is taken of the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle. On the headline, Deal Seeks $15 Minimum Wage. An SUV leaves the Missouri Rural Crisis Center. People serve themselves at a barbecue. Darvin.
We're getting really hard on how to organize, and when they start trying to discredit you and belittle you, you know you're making an impact.
Victoria at a meeting.
My question to you is, how can I be sure that you will advocate for me as your constituent? And can you guarantee me quality affordable healthcare? 26, the pre-existing condition, at that level of poverty level.
People wave flags and banners. Some get to their feet. Robert carries a box to speak on. He does a webcast.
It's office hours live. A lot of people until now have said, well, politics is out there, politics is for other people, are now understanding that they can't sit back.
The people in control have reason and means to keep us in separate groups and keep us angry at each other.
The strength you have is in numbers. Right. It's not just in guts.
That's right.
Des Moines, Iowa, then Roseville, California.
I ask you all to take 5 minutes out of your day and make at least one phone call to your congressperson, one phone call to your senator, and I guarantee you that if we continue doing so, we will succeed.
Next, Cotton Heights, Utah.
Do your job, do your job, do your job.
Houston, Texas.
The only way forward toward a system that works for the majority of us is to get organized and politically active.
Chicago, Illinois, and Gulf Coast, Louisiana.
The moneyed interests are doing what they do best, making money.
Detroit, Michigan.
The rest of us need to do what we can do best. Use our voices, our vigor, and our votes. It's up to us to change the rules.
Director Jacob Kornbluth. Robert dances in front of a bookcase. Producer Eden Wormfelt. Producer Yael Bridge.
If you're going to be a citizen activist, three things. Number one, you've got to be tenacious and patient. Social change does not happen quickly.
Co-director and editor Sari Gilman. Executive producers Ryan Smith, Steve Silberstein, Justin Shine, Steve Firestone.
Number two, talk to people who disagree with you. Get out of your bubble. Maybe they will convince you that you are wrong, or you'll convince them that they are wrong, but you've got to talk to them. Number three, have some fun.
Robert keeps on dancing with a smile. Executive producers Nicholas Morton, Rick Rosenthal, Ben Kottner, Jason Spingarn-Koff, Lisa Nishimura. Directors of Photography Andrew Black, Jesse Dana. Co-editor Catherine Garange. Supervising editor Lisa Fruchtman. Composer Marco D'Ambrosio. Eden Wormfeld Films. Whitewater Films. And Inequality Media. In order of appearance, Robert B. Reich, Claudia Nelson, Reverend Wallace Hartsfield II, Darvin Bentledge, Woody Kozad, Crosby Kemper, Annie Presley, Guadalupe Sanchez, Victoria Zorka, Dave Bratt, the Bentledge Family, Wealth and Poverty Student Instructors at UC Berkeley, Marion Cooper. Further credits continue to scroll. Copyright 2017, Saving Capitalism, The Movie, LLC. All rights reserved. Ownership of this motion picture is protected by copyright and other applicable laws of the United States and other countries. Any unauthorized duplication, distribution, or exhibition of this motion picture, including soundtrack, is prohibited and could result in criminal prosecution as well as civil liability. Saving Capitalism, The Movie, LLC is the author of this motion picture for the purpose of copyright and other laws. The Netflix logo in red.